Welcome to this episode of Why Pals Tales from the Superyacht Laundry. I am here today with the amazing man's Beaver. Although you've gone double barreled, I noticed recently.
Yes. Well, just using my actual name.
So how are you? How are you doing? This is second time around.
Yeah, right. Really good. Yep. It's the height of the season. Been doing lots of epic medical training and expeditions and cool boat shows and some speaking. And I love this time of year. It'd be nice to get to August and stop while everyone's at sea and with their bosses and lie by my pool and do nothing and feel absolutely not guilty about it. But right now I thrive on this time of year. I love getting everyone trained up for the season. The medical training, the psychological resilience. I just get to work with like all my best mates and so many great crew. Every boat's my favourite. And yeah, it's awesome.
It's actually like, obviously we were both at Palma and I have to say, I was sitting the day before I left and I was like, oh my God, there's actually quite a nice buzz. You know, when you're talking to crew and stuff like that, that excitement about starting the season and getting into it because it's been boring. Do you know what I mean? I was half tempted to go back on board, but I think my husband would probably have an issue.
No, I think that every time I train a great crew.
You're like, oh, it would be quite nice to, maybe just one trip. I'd probably die though, to be fair.
No, I think there's a really good buzz out there at the moment. You're right, because I think everyone's finally got through the pandemic and the fears and being locked in and that what happened with so many boats not exploring so much and now everything just feels like it's back and in flow and there's a lot of happy people out there. I think it's going to be a good season.
I think it's going to be a good season for everybody. I'm really hoping everybody stays safe, no disasters. There's quite a few sketchy things happened last year as well. So I think everybody's armed with more information. But anyway, we digress. We're here to tell your story. So obviously, I'll be completely honest, dear listeners. I have recorded Amanda before in Palma, and it went completely wrong halfway through, but we were so in-depth, engrossed in the conversation, didn't realise that the internet had dropped out. So we're going to go again.
I think that's because it was like 5, 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning.
It was really early. It was like 8 o'clock in the morning and the recording started fine, but it stopped after 40 minutes, which was just, great, just great. And then our schedules were just too hectic to be able to do it. And then, life just ended up getting in the way. Hmm. But let's start at the beginning. What was Mans doing before yachting? Where were you?
Well, I've been on boats my whole life. I've grew up in Hobart, Tasmania, and was on a boat at 4 weeks in a bassinet on my parents' boat. Apparently I was even shipwrecked as a child, as a baby.
What?
So, grew up sailing on the River Derwent. I remember my sister and I going around. There was a tall ships race in 1998. I was 12, showing my years. Such a secret. And there was, a lot of Sydney Hobart boats in and all these tall ships. And my sister and I were getting all their autographs. It's funny, when I went through the book, I found a lot of friends. I'm friends with now's names. Yeah, a lot of smelly sailors after the Hobart I'd got too. But we realised that you could actually sail around the world and make money doing it. And we decided that's what we wanted to do. Anyway, I went to the Caribbean when I was 18, did a season, and all my friends were in their 30s and I felt really young and I was one of the only ones without a degree. I'd started nursing but felt like I didn't have enough life experience to do it properly, and we were one of the first uni programs of nursing, which I actually didn't really agree with. I think it's better taught on the floor, but hey-ho, the uni is the way it goes now.
That's probably quite a bone of contention. That's not just your country, it's ours. A lot of industries have changed because they made it standardized that you're supposed to have a degree to be in it. And when it's a practical trade, that's kind of probably a bit counterproductive, no?
Mm. Well, some people get out after 3 years and realize they don't like humans. So they could have worked that out in week one if they actually had some patient contact. And actually, because of that, I am feeling disillusioned and being very rebellious and opinionated. I was like, you know what? I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to go through the old way myself. So then I went and became a carer. I did ski patrol. Then I did enrolled nursing. And then I became a paramedic. And then I finally went back and did registered nursing. So the whole thing, normally become a nurse in 3 years. And I think it was 6 years before I got my registered nursing. But by then I'd been running a ward. I'd been working in remote hospitals as an enrolled nurse. I'd been brought up as a carer by, you know, the carers are some of the best nurses around because they're really hands-on and they're not just dishing out drugs. And that those women and men, but mainly women that brought me up when I worked in aged care and remote hospitals, taught me so much.
When you say remote hospitals, can you just explain what you mean by a remote hospital?
Yeah, being Australian, obviously our got a very big country and a lot of it's really remote. I was always drawn, I mean, where I'm from is a remote environment. So I was always interested more in the rural and remote hospitals. And totally by accident, I ended up living down in the Tasman Peninsula and nursing at a place there. It's quite well known, but it's Port Arthur. The surfers know Shipstone's Bluff. So I was nursing down there. It was an hour and a half from Hobart. We were unfortunately, there was one of the world's biggest massacres there. And after that, we got telemedicine. And that was something that now I'm really passionate about and that we have on all the boats. And we had the very first set, one of the first sets in Australia for telemedicine. And it was like a big stack. Remember the stack of videos that you had at school, like going back really far? And yeah, so that was our stack. And then we could communicate with doctors in Hobart and Melbourne and get support, you know, if we had extreme and harsh environments or situations going on. Remote hospitals and remote communities tend to have a lot more issues. There's generally a lot of farming. So you get a lot of farming injuries there, you know, hands going through grain presses, legs chopped off by chainsaws. We had a fish farm down there. One of my best mates, Deepa, was attacked by a shark. We had a lot of people get, you know, the bends from diving on the pens down there.
You get exposed to a lot of things really quite intensely. Like, would you say you get more involved? Because there's probably not that many of you. Obviously, quite intense. So it's kind of literally baptism of fire. You've got to assist. It's not like going in a general hospital where there could be already a team. You kind of just observe, if you know what I mean. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And you're working for the community. So, you know, everyone's someone's cousin or friend or uncle or great aunt. And sadly, there's a really high incidence of suicide and mental health issues in rural and remote communities too, which is a growing problem. And also the amount of drownings is greatly increased in rural and remote communities as well. So, you know, we had some really tough things happen down there and it was definitely jumping straight into it.
So you decided to kind of cut your teeth when it comes to medicine just at the coalface, you know, it was more, less classroom, more let's just get into it kind of thing. When you did go back to do it, your, like, obviously your certification, did you feel like you had a different attitude towards it?
Oh yeah, I thrived, absolutely thrived, because I was already nursing and I'd already been nursing with a lot of the people that, you know, were my preceptors and people on the wards. Yeah, and I always remember Julie Cameron, if you're there, Julie, I love you, you inspired me so much, saying, because I was also working at the pub, I ran a pub down the road and I remember her drinking at the bar saying, it's the ones that last the longest, that take the longest are always the best nurses, Amanda. And I was really ready for it. I was also working in a nursing home and ski patrol in my last 2 years of nursing. So I was actively working in healthcare by the time I actually became a nurse. So the day I became a nurse, I went and ran the nursing home I was working in and went straight to work in the hospital I had done my training in and just jumped straight in. So, yeah, it's a great profession.
So when did the boats, after that, when did that come back in to your life?
My sister was already working on boats. We were inspired by our aunt, Trish Bailey. She's been a yacht captain since, and she sailed around the world a number of times and was a yacht captain in the British Virgin Islands. And that's who I'd spent my first season with when I was over there, and she helped me sort of get my first job when I was still a teenager.
She was rare. Like, but how, like, what year was that, like, to have a female captain? There wasn't many.
She'd been doing it
around
for years, but my first season was 1995 on yachts. And so my sister was already doing it. My passion was more for ski patrol and snowboarding. I really thought I was a bit of a pro snowboarder then. Couldn't be further from the truth, but anyway. And then I went to do a season in Switzerland, and my sister was on boats in the Caribbean, and she there was a chance I could come and do a delivery. And then that first night I walked into St. Martin, every person I met, actually that I live here in the village with, they're all my best friends, and it was including my husband. It was just bizarre. And then, but that was it. You know what it's like. I quickly realized I could afford to work on boats and still go skiing, but having, you know, being, you know, already a professional sailor, I realized I couldn't afford to be in ski fields and afford to go sailing. So I realized that, you know, the ski fields could wait till I was older, and this could be a really good way to go. And I'd already announced when I left nursing, you know, they went around the room and said, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? And all these girls are like, I'm going to run ICU, and I'm going to, and good on them, like, no disrespect, like, kudos to them. And I'm going to be cardiac thoracics. And I was like, I'm going to be a yacht medic. And I didn't even know what it meant. And everyone laughed, and they started calling me the Caribbean princess. And, you know, in those days there wasn't even a role. So, yeah, I did a couple of years sailing on a Swan 75, and cracked into, you know, that sort of regatta scene as well. And then a few years later, a friend of mine, Marty Krog, that's dead now, he came up to me, rang and said, I've just had this guy come on board and teach me how to use the oxygen and the medical kits. I've got his number, call him, and you should get that job. So I called the guy. That was sort of my into medical training on boats. And then I set up my own medical company, actually. And then I went back to Australia to pursue that, selling, it was called Marine Medical Kits Australia. And I was also teaching the AMSA guys in the commercial marine sector in Australia, in Fremantle, Western Australia, the marine medicine course, the ship captain's medical, that was hospital-based. And as everyone that trains with me knows, I'm very practical. I don't believe yachties are really designed to sit in front of a PowerPoint presentation. Most of us, you know, would rather be active. And it's such a good way to teach it. You know, we had the captains all come in for a week of night shifts, and we'd stitch and suture and cannulate and operate on usually drunk people, which probably wouldn't be politically correct now, but it was fine in the 90s. Yeah, and that's sort of what we did.
Well, in the beginning, so like when you were starting off, so obviously you were, you know, called to get this, you know, to be training. Or using it, was it more using equipment in the beginning, and the kind of training kind of ebbed out from the equipment itself? Or was the industry just like, we need more medical training because people are getting injured? Like, what was the mentality back then?
Well, when I first started, there didn't seem to be, I mean, I should really, you know, I'd have to sort of speak to the guys from MSOS and MedAir that were MSOS hadn't started then, MedAir was still at three or four different companies. But I don't think Yacht Lifeline even started until the America's Cup in New Zealand in 2003. So what I found is every boat I went on that were private sailing boats basically didn't really have an adequate medical kit. And, you know, wanting to do a job I really liked, I would then go to see a doctor, Dr. Tomo, one of the founders of Medical Support Offshore. At the time, we were in Hamble, so I'd go and see Tomo, and he'd write scripts, and then I'd go and make the medical, get all the scripts filled and put them all in boxes, more or less just like they are now. And then, funnily enough, I was doing one for the man I married, and we weren't together then, and then I offered to train them on it, and so I did some training, and then the next person wanted a kit, and the next, and it just kind of happened purely by chance, and me really enjoying mixing marine medicine and nursing, you know, together.
Do you think it, like, they crew a bit, you know, obviously very aware of the dangers, but wanted, you know, there was a realization that they needed to push for things to be a bit safer on board, you know, obviously, you know.
Yeah, I don't remember so many injuries back then. Or maybe it was just sort of more normal. I mean, everyone were doing, the serious captains were definitely doing the ship captain's medical course in commercial settings. There wasn't such a thing as onboard training then, to my knowledge. I'm sorry if anyone's listening and they were doing this in the 90s and the beginning of the millennium, but to my knowledge, it was normally in, like, you know, AMSA training in the maritime colleges. You would get that hospital-based training for commercial ship captains. It wasn't so much a thing in super yachting. I mean, we definitely had some pretty wild accidents then. It was something that had to come for sure.
Everybody was starting to take it a bit more seriously.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just one of those things, is like, how does, because if you look at where we are now and the different initiatives, you know, obviously we've gone through such a transition when it comes to physical safety. Obviously now it's kind of branching out into like mental and psychological safety as well as.
One thing I think we've got to remember is the boats were so much smaller then. So we had smaller workloads, smaller winches, smaller blocks, smaller, all the things that can bite you and trap you, smaller, you know, smaller breakages, smaller masts, small, you know. But I guess we got a lot. I mean, we definitely sailed through a lot more storms then because we didn't have the navigation equipment. So. Yeah, but I think one of the reasons for the injuries and what I'm really interested in is the mental health side of what happens post injuries and critical incidences on board. And in those days, you know, the gear's bigger, there's more people involved. When things go wrong now, they go really wrong. We've got so much tonnage. We've got such big bow waves got rocking down the deck, you know, that we used to only really see in the J class, but now we're seeing it in so many boats. Obviously, I'm more of a sailor than a motorboat person, but so, you know, it's that the boats have grown so big. I mean, we couldn't imagine a 200 or 300 foot yacht back then.
Yeah, I mean, a chain lock, you know, for example, a chain locker really back in the day and a chain locker now could be massive, you know. It's like a cruise ship kind of scenario. Incredible. So an injury in that kind of chain locker is a bit more, it's going to be a proper, you know, could be a fatal one. So obviously you're doing the medical kits on board and the education. Obviously in between all that, you're kind of sailing, having fun, like you're just doing everything. Because you also had to come back to re-accredit as a nurse periodically, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, well, like during those days I was based in London. So I was working in London as a nurse because after I did the work on the Swan, I was going crazy sailing across the oceans, you know, especially in the doldrums going, nursing or yachting, nursing or yachting. And I didn't know how to combine it. So, and I realized I needed to, well, I just, my passion was nursing as well. And then the racing. It was actually when there was an accident on board the yacht I was working on, and we had the kite up and it was about 30 knots. And the owner came up screaming, saying there was a disaster in her bedroom and in her cabin. And I thought it was we were going to be sinking and her soap had fallen over. I was like, right, this isn't going to work for me. I need to go and nurse some people that are really dying and really going through some disasters. I was lucky enough to have a job that you could work flexi time. So I was working, you know, at the Royal Free, St Mary's, Charing Cross, all the big hospitals in London. I was also working as a flight nurse. So I was, you know, flying all over the world doing evacuations and then prioritizing regatta sailing. So sailing on the Wallis, the Maxis, and a lot of classics and TP. So I was sort of doing a bit of freelancing. I was in my 20s. You could just go do whatever you wanted then. You know, I think I kind of lived at Heathrow Airport. I knew nearly all the staff by name. I used to sleep in the block hotel when I didn't have anywhere. I wasn't in a crew house or, you know, hotel for flight nursing or, you know, in the nurses' quarters in London.
So you, is this where kind of a development in the, and a passion for like initial crisis response kind of came? Because obviously, you know, people that have just been injured, the paramedic kind of situation, ICU, do you think you ended up leaning towards that? Because obviously all the kits are, you know, keeping that person alive to then get to hospital. Do you feel like you were kind of specializing in a way without even realizing it?
Yeah, for sure. I think my interest in crisis management and medicine response work came after the Port Arthur massacre, because it was something that none of us could have ever prepared for. And then I was a first responder at another massacre and gang fight in Brixton in like my first week nursing in London. It was like that was like being in a third world country in a war zone. I'd never stitched anyone before, and I was stitching someone that had been stabbed in the back, I think, 37 times. And I didn't even know how to do the stitching knot that you all know I teach very well now. And so I was like, I'll just do a reef knot. I just made it up because there was no one to ask. We all had so many patients. So, yeah, I just think, you know, God just threw me into some real disaster areas, and it became part of my practice. It's definitely more my style than being a ward nurse. That was never really interesting to me. I loved working with the old people, loved their stories. You know, in those days I worked with a lot of veterans. They were all veterans from World War One and Two, and it was such a privilege to nurse those, we call them diggers in Australia, and especially loved nursing the nurses, the old nurses and matrons from the war. But I was always better on the front line. For sure.
So it's that moment, that adrenaline moment where you're like hyper focused and it kind of comes your flow state, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah. Well, and now I realized I was just completely addicted to adrenaline. And
I think that's everybody who ends up working on board boats most of the time. Like, oh, you know, it was one of the reasons why it was hard to transition, I found.
Yeah.
Is because you do love those moments where it's like, backs against the wall, everything is going, do you know what I mean? I'm sure the sailing is the same experience, like it's super intense, and then you kind of get out the other side, off, oh god, but you do want it again. So you're trying to find the perfect marriage of medicine and yachting. How did that, because did you ever feel you didn't want to be on board, or was it, but you still wanted medicine, you know, you love both, but kind of slightly differently, you know?
No, I'll be completely honest with you. I felt like I didn't want to be on board the whole time I was working on private yachts. Sorry, no disrespect to anyone that does work in that industry. I found it incredibly challenging, coming from a world where you're helping people live and die to having people lose the plot over getting, you know, I don't know, a sesame seed on their sushi that they didn't want. It just didn't really, I couldn't comprehend it because I came from trauma, and you know, working in Aboriginal Australia and third world conditions or developing countries. So it was, I mean, I had the greatest sales of my life. I really enjoyed it, and I really found it hard because I thought I should want to be here and I should feel so grateful, that I found it all a bit confronting. And
how do you make your peace with that? Because that's, you know, at the end of the day,
I balance seasons with working in developing countries and crisis war zone and crisis areas. So every time a holiday, I'd normally go and work in a crisis area until I realized I was better off to, you know, work, do the racing, some deliveries, and continue working as a nurse and a paramedic.
Is that drive to find more meaning? Is it like, is it making your time worthwhile? So like you say, you know, you could be just cruising around a boat trying to make Madame and Sir happy, but you could be spending your time trying to actually make something better or help someone.
I think it was just a natural progression, really.
I suppose it's one of those things when you work in that environment, it's kind of coming to terms with that. You could be, you know, you see in real terms the amount of wealth and how disparaging the world is. You know, you really do see the haves and the have-nots. So it's kind of finding your own peace in that as well.
Yeah, yeah, because I did feel guilty being part of it, like enjoying it and getting paid to do it. It felt sort of ridiculous when then I'd go and get paid way more, twice as much to work in the trenches and, you know, see people, work with people at the lowest of the low. And then I kind of found I enjoyed, I actually found I was a lot happier doing that than, you know, than say serving people on super yachts. So I was always, I've always loved everything I do. But the thing is, when you're a nurse and growing up the way I did, my life has always been, you know, keep moving, keep moving, keep moving, and the next opportunity comes and you're like, well, I'll do it. So I think it just was everything I needed to do to get to where I am now. Now it all makes sense. At the time, I don't know, maybe it was attention deficit disorder and I was just jumping from one thing to the next. So I've got no idea, but I just loved all of it. But yeah, I found my happy place in the end.
So yacht medic, was that previous wild medic?
Like, is yeah, well, I've got
next generation.
I have both brands, but at the moment I'm just working a lot more, focused a lot more on the yacht medic because the vision for the wild medic's a lot larger. That's incorporating all aspects of wilderness medicine. And right now I just want to, I just really want to focus on yachting, and it's my home and my community and all the things we were talking about before we started the podcast. The wild medic sort of drumming away in the background. I do a lot of wilderness medicine work. I guess when you get a, you know, when you're working on your career, you keep niching down and niching down and niching down. And while I love being in the wilderness, but my expertise is in marine medicine. You know, I love rock climbing. I love horse riding. I love, you know, rafting. I love all those things, but I'm not a professional in any of them, and I actually don't have much experience. So, I think I just realized that marine medicine is where I've spent my life and what I really want to continue to niche down into.
I was just looking over before you came on about, I was looking at the yacht medic stuff. And what I really like about it, it's just really simple. Do you know what I mean? It's a lot of it is just breaking it down into very easy, digestible, you know, it doesn't need to be intimidating. I think the industry, when it comes to a lot of different things, not just medicine, could do with just breaking it down into its simplest form, a lot of it, you know, because like all industries, yachting has its own language, bit like finance and stuff like that, you know, we have these terminologies and stuff. That's before you even get to like regulations and bits and pieces. But from a everyday person working on board kind of approach, I really like some of the stuff that you're putting out, because it just gets the brain thinking, but it's not thinking in a way that even if you've only been on board for 6 months, you're not going to be able to comprehend.
Yeah, and just before we go on, I just want to be really clear that when I'm working on boats, you know, as a marine medic and a medical trainer, I'm representing medical support offshore, MSOS, who most of you got kits from. If you don't, you should. They're great. But then my personal brand is the Yacht Medic. And I'm definitely, you know, quite outspoken. There's a few, you know, I can never teach enough. There's a lot of things I think that aren't included in the MCA. So I basically think of my work at the Yacht Medic, which is just Amanda Hewson Beaver, is I call it day six. And it's all the things that I think should be in the ship captain, in the medical care on board ships, aka ship captain's medical, and aren't, because we don't have time for. But I'm sorry for anyone in the MCA listening now and all my colleagues at MSOS that may not agree with me, but I think it's a little outdated. You know, we don't even have women's health included in that content, and more or less, you know, we're getting close to 50% of us in the world are women, and especially on boats, the numbers are growing. And why don't we? And I actually mentioned it a while ago in a course, and someone said, "Yeah, well, that's why women are bad luck at sea, because they have ovarian cysts." And it's the only time I've ever kicked someone out of the
pool. I bet that person got a really nice.
They were politely asked to leave and think about what they said and come back and apologize to women, or don't come back at all. And I would have said that if I was a man too. You know, that's not, you know, yeah, being feminist. It just was quite mind-blowing that those beliefs still, I mean, but it was good because I didn't actually realize that's where those beliefs came from. I was like, well, back in the first settler days, yeah, in the days of Christopher Columbus and Abel Tasman and you know, all the greatest sailors and explorers of the world, then maybe it was, you know, we had babies, we had periods, we had miscarriages, and we died in childbirth, and we had ovarian cysts. So maybe they really did believe that. So it's quite interesting to look into the history, but it's also time to change some of those things. Same goes with mental health. You know, I really love the mental health first aid work. I'm one of their greatest supporters. Why is that not included in the medical care on board ships? So there's a tiny bit of touching on it. I know we don't have a lot of time, and the, you know, 5 days isn't enough to really train you to do everything we need you to do. So that's what I'm focusing on, my work, my blogging and the socials I share, and what I'm sharing is constantly just answering questions I get asked, and people are always saying, why isn't this in the content? But mainly it's because we don't have time. I mean, we don't have dive medicine, we don't have free diving medicine, we don't have combat medicine, have polar medicine, we don't have desert medicine. So there's that's the thing with medicine. There's just so many fields, and we have to keep it really brief and just make sure you guys know how to use the kits and save a life at sea. But there's so much more I'd like to share. So that's sort of where those foundations have come from.
I think when it comes to all of these things, there's a number of factors. One factor is that information, we are going through, you know, they're saying like a second industrial age, you know, the internet is now literally fully kicking in with what it's capable of. And the information is there. Now, the powers that be within the yachting industry have done a fab job up until now, but I don't think they maneuver as fast as the information is out there. And I think, you know, there's a lot of frustration at the moment, a bit like yourself, you know, it can be updated, but the how and that process is obviously quite slow and laborious. So, you know, with also it moving at a rapid rate, each subject moving at a rapid rate of knots doesn't help. You know, even if they got faster, everything is still moving. I mean, mental health is, you know, the Pandora's box. We are learning literally new stuff every single day about how, and then how that interacts with physiology on board and stress levels and hormone levels and all kinds of stuff like that. I mean, from the women's perspective, are we bad luck at sea? I am actually going to do some research because I want to know, because I think a lot of it would be to do with how to control men back in the day. Because if obviously there's a woman on board, you know, God forbid that they would have to control their urges. This is back in the day, not now, you know, back in the day. But also, like you said, women have vulnerabilities. So are the men focused on the job if they've got to protect the women and protect the children? I'd like to think it comes from more that kind of women are bad luck on board because men can't focus on the job because they want to protect them and make sure we're nice. So let's put it that way rather than, you know, could engineer it another way. But you, like you said, and also a lot of entities and way people go about things, like when we spoke to Joanna Drysdale, works at MHG, I asked her to look at some figures because obviously within the insurance, how it's structured is it's supposed to be gender blind for obviously the purposes of us, you know, getting equality. But what we're affected by is completely different, which you can't ignore that either. So it's got to kind of be a marriage of both, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Coming to terms with it. So you've got new and exciting stuff on the horizon?
Yeah, at the moment I'm just really finalising the psychological first aid. So that's very different from the mental health first aid. So I'm really passionate about psychology and resilience. When I was at a conference for wilderness medicine in Australia last year, because I'm lucky enough to work at the University of Tasmania where we run the marine medicine, that's my baby, the extreme sports and expedition medicine, space medicine, extreme austere and harsh environments. And so we were going into an expedition where we take people out to sea, a bunch of nurses, doctors and paramedics, and then pretend there's weirdly a knockdown, quite like what we saw last year in Italy, or a fire on board. We've done a few different scenarios. Everyone has to abandon ship. they think that they're going to get picked up and then they have to survive in southern Tasmania, normally in the rain and wind, for a few days before the boat comes back to pick them up. And so, well, I was preparing for that, and I was feeling really disillusioned with mental health on super yachts. There wasn't at the time a lot of answers. Emma Mel hadn't started the mental health first aid. I was desperately looking for answers, and I had so many students asking for help. And then I was at the Wilderness Medicine, and a doctor called Dr. Kate Barcher was presenting her own version of psychological safety in expeditions and in wilderness medicine, because she is a psychologist, had been climbing Mount Blanc, saw someone die, and it was on her as a paid client in a group to look after everyone. And so she formulated this plan, and I basically stalked her and begged her to collaborate with me. And because basically there was no point reinventing the wheel. She had really defined what I find really interesting when in a critical incident, how to look at care of the crew, when to outsource to get, you know, a team of psychs in. And I really think that we should have a team of psychs in, available, which we do now, but really readily available, that everyone feels comfortable with, and everyone even knows who they want to work with, so they've got someone to call. But what my issue is knowing when to evacuate, you know, knowing when too much is too much, knowing how to debrief. I've been on boats that have had critical incidents so that have just carried on and gone to the pub and no one's ever mentioned it again, where there's been, I know, a lot of mental health issues as ongoing from that, because it wasn't handled properly, because the education and the foundations weren't there.
You're talking about processing trauma,
yeah,
and yeah, the knock-on effect if you don't process trauma or not aided to process trauma correctly.
Yeah, and just the management of a team after a critical incident. And until recently, there hasn't been great foundations in that, really. So yeah, and then I did every first mental health and psychological first aid and safety course there was on the planet. And so now Mel Harris and Kate Bacher and Kate Diddlegill and I are working on they're all psychologists, and we're working on a, they've come from the military. They haven't come from super yachting, but it's quite similar. And we're working on a certified program for psychological first aid that's yachting specific. So I've got a team of amazing psychologists that have been in battlefields in extreme austere and harsh environments in Antarctica, Mont Blanc, and offshore as well. And then we're making a yachting specific psychological first aid model to that, which is very different to the mental health first aid. It's all understanding when people have to be evacuated. Because as we all well know, if you and I have been working on a boat and sailing together for 2 years, sharing a cabin, and we both went through a really nasty incident, say your boyfriend got his leg chopped off, and then you're not okay, and then I'm trying to kind of protect you, keep it secret, look after you myself, even maybe trying to be your psychologist or life coach, and I don't want you to be evacuated because we're in the South China Sea and I don't know where you're going to go, you know, and so what we need is a really clear framework of when people are not safe to be on board and they need to go and get help. It's very pragmatic. It's basically a flow chart, you know, with a traffic light system of green, orange, and red, that really helps us clearly define when people need help, when they need to be evacuated, or when they are just processing trauma and are probably okay, because you know what, it's actually normal to do that, but sometimes it can go on too long. And it fits really well. I'm working really closely with Emma and Mel and to sort of work together with them to get it out there. And so that our courses, all the medical first aid, the mental health first aid, and the psychological first aid all work together in unison, and we're not trying to compete and cover the same material. They're all completely different and all very valid and all extremely necessary.
Amazing. Sounds amazing. Sounds amazing. I would really like, because the problem we've got, man, is we've got too much to talk about.
Yeah. We'll have to do it again.
Too much to cover. I mean, we've skipped across the surface of your actual physical experience, you know, within the industry, and then obviously barely scraped the surface of what you've been doing recently and what you've got going on potentially in the future. So,
well, now I have to go because I'm going on a marine expedition with Save the Med, an amazing environmental organization here whose main sort of priority is to take the message from community to policy. And yeah, we've got a month of expeditions, and we're doing turtle catch and release, stingrays, sharks.
Amazing.
Numbers, all different scientists and marine biologists from around the world are coming on board, and my job is to keep everyone safe. So I've got to rush down to Andrax now and jump on the Bonnie Lass with Captain Pete and Brad. And yeah, we're going to run some drills, and I think we've got a helicopter that's going to, you know, the search and rescue, we're going to do a helicopter drill. And yeah, it's pretty exciting. So things are coming together today.
Well, I won't keep you too much longer for your amazing day, but I will say let's get you back on.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And let's kind of nail down and maybe talk about, you know, especially the work with trauma and kind of where that's heading, and then how you, what you're doing will strengthen the mental health side of things as well. And I, you know, everybody will be super keen to listen to how to maybe get all of these things to function in unison, not in competition with each other. I think that's probably the best thing I've heard in a few weeks, if I'm honest. I have to say. We'll do your crazy story about yachting the next time, but thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
So much love. Thank you. Thanks for having me on board.
No problem at all. Until the next time, thank you so much for coming on. Dear listeners, there's more to come, more amazing interviews, and that's just me talking to Amanda. So, yeah, we'll speak to you all soon.